proceed to the fourth case of the day, Stinnett versus LaPlante. Mr. Matheson.
May it please the court, counsel of record. My name is Harry Matheson. I'm appearing here on behalf of the debtor and appellant David Stinnett in both of these appeals. These appeals have, of course, been consolidated and for a very good reason. And that is that I believe there is one issue that really serves as the focal point in both these cases. And if I may, I want to start with that. There are two appeals here, but both of the appeals, although separately, come down to basic considerations of relatively limited legal issues. And it's a different one in each case. But there is this one overriding question, and that is, what is the impact on both these cases of the fact that the guardian disability payments are entirely post-petition? By that, what I mean is the payments are being made post-petition, and the entitlement to the payment arises post-petition. The court probably remembers from the briefs that there's a separate Northwestern disability that was, in fact, pre-petition. That is a very significant point, and I believe it is essential to both these cases for this reason. With regards to the appeal relating to the exemption, I don't believe it was proper for the bankruptcy court or the district court, for that matter, to consider as part of any determination of what is reasonable and what is not post-petition payments. Now, we can argue endlessly about the other issue that is involved in that case, and that is, does the Indiana Constitution require that a allowance for an exemption for the disability be limited to a reasonable amount? The bankruptcy court decided that a reasonable amount was $6,000, and anything over and above that should be considered property of the estate and distributed to creditors. Well, the fact of the matter is that the Northwestern policy, which was the only one that was paying or under which Mr. Stinnett was entitled to receive anything at the time of the bankruptcy, once you took out the amount that was being paid to the ex-wife under the property settlement agreement, amounted to $6,000. The real question there, if you're looking for a way to sidestep the constitutional issue and not confront directly, is the disability money from guardian properly considered? I don't believe it is, for the very reason that it is entirely post-petition. If I am right about that, then in effect the constitutionality issue is not really critical to a determination of appeal number one, if I can call it that, because you can affirm Judge Lorch and the district court in finding that $6,000 is proper, payable out of Northwestern, but that it was improper to consider post-petition disability and post-petition payments. Ergo, there was no reason to include the guardian disability payments as a part of the property of the estate.
Well, the disability claim at issue here arose pre-petition. It just wasn't made until post-petition.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think the truth of the matter is that Mr. Stinnett was disabled because of his emotional condition prior to filing bankruptcy. The problem is that the guardian policies do not entitle or did not entitle him to receive a disability payment simply because he was disabled. That policy was a policy he had by virtue of being an employee of guardian. That policy required two prongs before he can receive anything. Prong number one is he'd be disabled, which I believe you are correct in saying he was. Prong number two is that he is no longer employed by guardian. He was still employed by guardian. at the time of his filing bankruptcy, and that continued for several weeks after he filed bankruptcy. Consequently, the reason Guardian denied his claim for a pre-petition disability, and it's important to remember that he did submit a claim for pre-petition benefits under the Guardian policy, was not because he wasn't disabled, because he didn't meet the second prong of the test. So I think your question, as stated, you're exactly right. He was disabled. But simply being disabled did not entitle him to a payment under the Guardian policies. He also had to be unemployed by Guardian.
But his claim as filed did seek pre-petition payments.
But was disallowed.
Well, I understand that, but even as the debtor understood his own claim, it arose pre-petition, and the fact that it was disallowed because he remained employed during a period of that time, it doesn't change the nature of the claim for purposes of determining whether it was the property of the estate.
No, I disagree with that. I think it does change it. I think it may not change the nature of the claim, but it changes his entitlement to the claim. As we all remember from law school, property is your bundle of rights that you have. By virtue of the fact that he was still employed, Mr. Stent did not have the right to claim that disability payment, or at least to receive it. And I think that is a critical fact. Now, that is really the critical fact that relates to appeal number two, which is the battle with the IRS over the Guardian payments and whether that lien attaches to it or not. Again, I think the fundamental considerations are the same. It is a post-petition payment. As of the date of the filing of the bankruptcy, Mr. Stennett had no entitlement to it. Ergo, the value of the secured claim of the IRS was zero.
Would you agree that if we conclude that the Guardian policy was property of the estate, that the debtor has no standing to pursue the argument about the IRS tax lien?
Yes. If it's property of the estate.
Okay.
But I don't believe it's property of the estate.
I understand that, but if we go against you on that, then we don't even get to the merits of the tax lien issue.
I think that's exactly
right. Because that's for
great.
The trustee.
If the trustee's entitled to it, we're gone.
Okay.
We're out of the picture entirely. Okay. I have reserved 3 minutes. I believe that's right on target.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Kowalik?
May it please the court and counsel. My name is James Kowalik of Holstile & Kowalik, and I represent the trustee, Mr. LaPlante, in this matter. In light of the amount of time that I've been allotted, I would like to concentrate on the appeal the debtor has made, contending that he is entitled to unlimited exemption. I would first, however, point out that the trustee raised before the district court, and again raises with this court, the lack of jurisdiction of this appeal. It's the trustee's contention that the appeal should have been from a March 4th, 2003 order in which Judge Lorch set the amount of the exemption under the Foster standard, which is the reasonable necessities of life, at $6,000 per month. We believe this is the order that should have been appealed from. The later September 12th order merely adjusted the source of where that $6,000 amount that was exempt came from in light of his decision concerning the Guardian funds. Basically, the court found that the Guardian funds are property state, belong to the trustee. That was the money from which Mr. Stennett was getting his $6,000, so the court readjusted that amount. It didn't change the $6,000 at all, and I would refer the court to this court's decision in the Oakley matter, which found that a definitive adjudication of an entitlement to a definite amount was a final appealable order. Turning to the substance of the debtor's arguments, it's basically a two-prong argument. And basically, the debtor is arguing that there's a factual distinction between the Foster decision the Indiana Supreme Court decided and the this case. I think the court need look no further than the certification of the question to the Indiana Supreme Court. This was a case that was certified from the district court as to a question to the Indiana Supreme Court to decide. That decision was whether the life insurance exemption violated the Indiana statute, which limited exemption to what's reasonably necessary for the comforts, necessary comforts of the debtor. That was the issue that was presented to the Indiana Supreme Court. It wasn't the issue of whether the debtor in Foster was a sophisticated debtor who converted his non-exempt assets to exempt assets and therefore shouldn't be allowed to have an unlimited exemption. In light of my time, Your Honor, I would like to move on. The second prong of the argument that the disability is akin to earnings and therefore is entitled to an exception under 541A6 of the Bankruptcy Code, which provides that earnings from services performed by the debtor after commencement of the case are not property of the state. Very quickly, Your Honor, if you look at the series of cases that the district court reviews and that's in the briefs, these courts find that this exception is to be very narrowly construed, extremely narrowly, according to this court in the Prince case, and that basically a substitute for earnings, such as a settlement from a where you get post-petition future earnings as an award, would not be the same thing as earnings. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kowalik. Mr. Rosenberg?
May it please the Court, I'm Kenneth Rosenberg, appearing for Internal Revenue Service. I want to make two major points, the first one being that the Court does not have jurisdiction over this appeal insofar as he is raising the question of the property of the estate, whether his disability payments were property of the estate. And the second point is, should this Court reach the merits, it's clear that his disability payments were both property of the estate and subject to the federal tax lien. This case arises from a somewhat complicated procedural posture, so I want to review quickly how it arose. In the bankruptcy court, there was an adversary proceeding brought by the trustee to determine whether these disability payments, the guardian disability payments, were property of the estate. And the Internal Revenue Service intervened in that to assert its federal tax lien. And that led to the bankruptcy court's order, which held that it was that those payments are property of the bankruptcy estate, but they were not subject to the federal tax lien. Separate from that, there was a contested matter in which the debtor disputed how much of an exemption he was entitled to. That led to the other order of the bankruptcy court, which held that there was $6,000 of exempt amount he was entitled to. So then it went up to the district court on those two separate appeals, and the district court affirmed the holding on the exemption amount being $6,000, and I would like to reiterate what my co-counselor, counsel for the trustee, said, that we feel that the district court erred in not dismissing that appeal for being untimely. And then secondly, the district court affirmed the bankruptcy court's holding that the disability payments were property of the estate and reversed the bankruptcy court's holding that they were not subject to the federal tax lien. So then we come up on two separate appeals to this court, and counsel said that the appeals were consolidated, and that was not correct, or at least not completely correct, because they were consolidated for purposes of argument and disposition. They were not consolidated for purposes of briefing. And this brings us to the jurisdictional point, which is that he did not list in his statement of issues on appeal for this appeal from the order on the property of the estate and the tax lien the issue whether the payments were property of the estate, nor did he brief that issue in his opening brief before this court. So he has waived that issue, and given that it is established that those payments are property of the bankruptcy estate, Because there are more liabilities than assets in the bankruptcy estate, the only effect that the court's holding can have on the tax lien issue is which creditor ends up getting these payments. Therefore, it's moot as to the debtor, that particular issue. So that's our argument that the court lacks jurisdiction. So then to move on to the merits of the case, assuming that we don't win on the jurisdictional point, assuming that the court does have jurisdiction over the appeal, we're dealing with two sub-issues, you could say, which is whether it's proper these guardian payments are property of the estate and whether they are subject to the federal tax lien. And those, of course, are governed by the respective provisions in the Bankruptcy Code and in the Internal Revenue Code. And those two provisions have similar language that includes in the bankruptcy estate or in property subject to the federal tax lien all property or all interests of property in property that the taxpayer or the bankrupt person has. So the question then being, he had, at the time he filed his bankruptcy petition, a federal tax lien had been filed against him, and there's no dispute as to the validity of that. However, he had not yet begun to receive his disability payments. The question is whether he had a right to receive those of such a nature that it would be included in the bankruptcy estate and it would be subject to the federal tax lien. And we've cited a lot of precedent and discussed a lot to show that his right to receive those disability payments was matured and that so it was subject to those to the federal tax lien. His argument is that because he was nominally still employed by Guardian, that he was not actually eligible for the disability payments. So his right was not matured and it did not rise to that level. However, the record reflects that, as Your Honor commented on opening argument, he was entitled to his disability payments, and it was simply a matter of him doing paperwork to terminate his employment and to file a claim for those disability payments. And the record makes clear by his own admissions that he made a conscious choice not to do that, to continue his employment status rather than apply for his disability payments. The reason he did that, the record makes clear, is that he simply collected more money from, I believe it was from his renewal commissions from his insurance policies that he had written before he had become disabled. So I think it's clear, although there's not any cases that are exactly on these particular facts, but there are a lot of cases that we've cited that show that when a person has the right to collect something and it's simply a matter of putting in a claim for it, that is property that is both part of a bankruptcy estate and subject to the federal tax lien. So, and we rely principally in this regard on the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Bess, which talked about cash surrender of life insurance, which even though the insured person has not applied for it or asked to be paid that, it's still considered subject to the federal tax lien, and the dry trust case of the Supreme Court also, which held that a disclaimer was not effective to avoid the federal tax lien because in disclaiming, the person exercised control over the disposition of the inheritance.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen.
Thank you.
Mr. Matheson.
May it please the court, counsel. In 3 minutes, I want to make 2 points. Number one is that the question about the jurisdictional issue is not really for this court. Whether the district court correctly or incorrectly decided that the appeal was timely is not something that has been raised on a cross appeal. It is also not something that has been raised in the trustee's brief in this case. That issue is not for this court. The appeal is, by virtue of the cross appeal, not having been filed timely at this point in time. Judge Young ruled that it was, and no cross appeal was taken from that. The issue of the IRS lien attaching, I think, comes down very clearly to the same issue that Your Honor raised earlier on my presentation. And at the risk of being repetitive, I guess I have to say that again, because it is critical, and none of us can come to this court and point to any specific case which makes it abundantly clear how that issue comes out. But we can look at the facts of this case, and I think it becomes clear exactly what happened here. Mr. Stinnett was, I believe, disabled prior to May 30th, 2000, when he filed his bankruptcy petition. But he did not have a right to draw the guardian benefits until, I believe, the actual date that guardian gave was July 19th of 2000. Now, the question becomes, was Judge Young correct in saying that we're going to pull the post-petition payments in, subject them to the IRS lien, because Mr. Stinnett could have gotten that pre-petition? Now, the argument is basically sound with one flaw, and that is, as Mr. Rosenberg points out, to do that, Mr. Stinnett had to quit his job. The question for the court is, why didn't he quit that job? And the reason is, again, as Mr. Rosenberg set out, because, rightly or wrongly, Mr. Stinnett came to the conclusion that he would make more money by remaining employed than he would make off the disability. Now, that is a legitimate point. There is no section of the Internal Revenue Code, there is no section of the Bankruptcy Code that I'm aware of that says everyone must go work at the job that will make the most money for the IRS to be able to attach pursuant to their lien. If Mr. Stinnett thought he could make more money by remaining employed, he had every right to do so. The IRS position is rather bizarre. They want him to be disabled pre-petition, but their position will force him to go back to work, which they cannot attach post-petition. For that reason, we urge the court to reverse both these appeals and sustain the finding or the request of the appellant that the IRS lien does not attach to post-petition benefits, that the post-petition benefits should not be considered meet for the exemption in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Matheson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.